Good afternoon. Welcome to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. You know, there's three relatively common viral infections we've probably all heard of. They sound very similar in name, but they're really quite different in their communicability, their complications, their prevention, and their treatment. For example, immunization has been so successful that almost all of the hepatitis A being seen in Alaska now is acquired somewhere else by those who are not immunized. Immunization is also eliminating hepatitis B as well and helping prevent transmission from the infected mothers to their babies. More than 90% of patients with hepatitis C are being cured of this particularly life-threatening, life-shortening, cancer-causing illness. However, 25 to 50% of those infected with hepatitis C don't even know they have it. Today, we're going to be discussing hepatitis A, B, and C on this edition of Line One, Your Health Connection. My guests today are nurse practitioner Ann Hewitt. Ann works with patients who have hepatitis and other liver diseases, particularly hepatitis C. She works at the Liver Disease and Hepatitis Program at Alaska Native Medical Center. And Dr. Brian McMahon is co-chair of the World Health Organization Hepatitis B Guidelines, and he also helped develop the Hepatitis B Guidelines for the U.S. Practice Committee. Dr. McMahon is medical director of the Liver Disease and Hepatitis Program at ANMC, and this is his third or fourth time to come on the program to talk about hepatitis. And it's particularly with hepatitis C, things are changing very quickly right now. Brian, it's good to have you back.
Thanks very much, Thad. I'm glad to be back. And this is hepatitis screening month, actually, in the U.S., and so it's an appropriate time to talk about hepatitis. And as part of our talk, we'll tell you who should be screened for different types of viral hepatitis.
Now, this is for listeners in my age group. It's an important program to be listening to, my age group and slightly younger. And Annette, welcome. This is your first time.
Yes, thank you, Thad.
All right, if you have questions or comments during the program today, there's a couple of ways you can get in touch with us. Our first way is our typical phone call number for local individuals, 550-8433, 550-8433. Toll free, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. You want to spell out line one, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all in one word. This is a great opportunity. If you've got questions about hepatitis, you probably can't do better than to call in and get some answers to those questions today. So if you have questions or comments or experiences you want to share, this is the time to do it. Brian, the obvious place I think to start is just to briefly describe hepatitis A, B, and C in somewhat general terms, and then we'll dig into things a little deeper.
Sure, I'd be glad to do that. So there's actually five kinds of hepatitis, but we really only see three of those or have seen three of those in Alaska. Hepatitis A is what's called a fecal-oral virus. It's transmitted by contaminated feces and orally, and it gets into it can contaminate food and water. And Alaska used to have the highest rate of hepatitis A, primarily in recurring epidemics, in the United States and one of the highest in the world. But since universal vaccination by the state of Alaska starting in 1995, we have less than 100,000 a year. So we've actually gone from the highest to the lowest. Less than one case per 100,000 people in the state per year. So that's only less than a half dozen cases. And as Dr. Woodard mentioned, almost all of those patients are people who travel to an endemic area because all children are vaccinated up to the age of 18, or they're people who traveled and brought it back and gave it to someone else in their household or one of their friends. So the only people who really need to be concerned about this are people who are going to go to Mexico on Alaska Airlines or some other airline, or they're going to go to someplace else in the Caribbean or Africa or Asia or somewhere where there's a lot of hepatitis A, and then they should be vaccinated by their practitioner, and then they'll get lifelong immunity from that vaccine. So hepatitis B is a bloodborne virus, but it is a very infectious and contagious bloodborne virus, one of the most infectious and contagious bloodborne virus around. And that is because the virus can survive on environmental surfaces indefinitely. So HIV dies in a few minutes on an environmental surface, hepatitis C in a day or two. Hepatitis B can live indefinitely on an environmental surface, and it can be spread by people with open cuts and scratches, mosquito bites that are they're scratching and they lean against the table and contaminate that table with the virus. Another person comes along and gets infected through an open cut and scratch. It also is transmitted from infected mother to child, and that's why all women in the United States are tested for hepatitis B when they're pregnant. And for the reason that it's such an infectious virus, we start vaccination at birth in the United States and in the world. And in Alaska, we've been vaccinated since the early 1990s, all children up to the age of, starting at birth, up to the age of 20 years of age. Over in older people, the risk is primarily through other means of transmission, including injecting, drug use, contaminated medical contamination, like using a needle that's not completely sterilized. There's been some transmission through endoscopy tubes, and they're trying to correct that now. And also sexual transmission. It's the most sexually easily transmitted disease around. And if you get hepatitis B as a child or an infant, you have a very high chance you'll have chronic hepatitis B. You won't get sick, and you will go on the rest of your life with chronic hepatitis B, which can lead to cancer. Hepatitis C is another bloodborne virus. It's way harder than hepatitis B to transmit. It's very difficult to transmit sexually, but easy to transmit through injecting, drug use, or by blood transfusion prior to the screening blood in 1990, and even prior to good medical practice of using gloves and better sterile technique than we did 20 years ago, even through medical practices. And we'll talk a little bit, Annette will talk a little bit about which people should be screened, because hepatitis C is a silent disease, silent infection, that can lead to liver cancer and liver cirrhosis and liver-related death.
All right. Let me just give our phone number out again to individuals who might be listening before we get into these in a little bit more depth. Let me remind listeners again, this is Line 1, Your Health Connection. My guest is Dr. Brian McMahon and nurse practitioner Annette Hewitt. Both are specialists in the care and treatment of individuals with hepatitis. They both work at the Liver Disease and Hepatitis Program at ANMC. Our local number, 550-8433, 550-8433. Toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. Brian, I want to just quickly, I don't think we need to spend nearly as much time on hepatitis A, but I want to come back to that, which to me is one of these remarkable stories that gets missed by the public. So in 1995 to today, roughly 21 years, we've almost eradicated or dramatically changed hepatitis A. I know in my lifetime as a pediatrician, we used to see outbreaks or cases every once in a while from kids in daycare. And what was really difficult about hepatitis A is it's relatively mild illness, especially in young kids. They often didn't get jaundiced, and we'd figure out that it was hepatitis A long after the fact when an adult got jaundiced. So it's a much milder illness in general than these other two that we're talking about.
Yeah, that's really correct. That it's if you get it as a young child, you usually don't get sick, or you get a flu-like illness that's not recognized. But majority of adults, more than half, when they get hepatitis A, will turn yellow and be quite ill with it. Mm-hmm. Rarely do they die, but it's not uncommon when we had these big epidemics up here to see people that were pretty much incapacitated as far as working or going to school for, you know, two or three months. So it was a very morbid disease, but it was not a very high mortality disease. And it's remarkable that this vaccine, which just two shots of it, and it's a killed virus recombinant vaccine, so it doesn't have any live virus in it. There are live virus vaccines which are being looked at in other countries, but not in the United States. And that vaccine gives, we've been doing long-term studies on the protection, and in children and toddlers who are vaccinated, that protection lasts for at least 20 years and probably lifelong. Two shots, and it's almost 100% effective. So if you're going to go to Mexico or someplace and you're an adult and you didn't get the vaccine, please go to your provider. Any provider can do this and get vaccinated. And if you're a child and you've been vaccinated and you're going to Mexico, no worries about that. You're protected against hepatitis A.
Yeah, I'm not a world's expert by any means about immunizations, but I think of hepatitis A as probably one of our very best at generating an immune response and the least likely to even have side effects associated with it. Is that the way you think about that vaccine?
Yeah, I don't know of any serious side effect that's ever been associated with hepatitis A vaccine, that's ever been reported with hepatitis A vaccine. And it literally is pretty much in people with a good immune system, which means almost all of us, 100% effective, essentially. And even one dose gives you 95% within 2 weeks. So if you get your shot, you're going to Mexico, you get it a couple weeks before you go, even if you have finished the series, you're going to have protection.
So the comment I often try to say is, what's the risk of doing something? What's the risk of not? Parents or patients always ask, what's the risk of this treatment? And I'm always saying, well, you want to, what's the risk of not doing it? So the risk of getting the vaccine is infinitesimally small, if even present at all. We hate to say never. And the illness, at least in adults, is a nasty illness. And a certain percentage of people can last for several months.
Yeah, and the reason that people get it in countries like Mexico, and I've had several friends and even some relatives that have gotten acute hepatitis A back in the 80s, 70s in traveling to Mexico. And the reason that it's so infectious is that they don't vaccinate in these countries, although some of these countries are starting to vaccinate now. And everyone gets hepatitis A when they're young, and they don't get sick. And then especially toddlers and infants can shed that virus in their stool for months, and they contaminate water, they contaminate food, an adult comes along from the U.S., and all the adults in that country have already been exposed when they were kids, so they've got lifelong immunity. Mm-hmm. One thing is hepatitis A does not cause chronic disease like hepatitis B and C. But when one of us comes along and goes to Mexico and drinks one of those slurries and the tequila slush or whatever, we get hepatitis A if we haven't been vaccinated. So that's the reason that you want to get vaccinated. And just about every case, we have a EIS officer over at CDC that's looking into this right now, and he's gone back more than 20 years. And every case, literally almost every case, is due to somebody who traveled to an endemic country, or they came back with it and gave it to someone in their household or close contact.
And it's not just in Alaska. Throughout the United States, the incidence of hepatitis A, I guess, has dropped precipitously over the last 20 years.
Yeah, it's about 1 to 2 per 100,000. It's a little lower in Alaska, but and it's the same thing in the lower 48. It's people who travel to endemic places that get it.
And there is increasing travel worldwide, and so what you're saying is an individual who has never been immunized and never had hepatitis A, and if they had hepatitis A as an infant, they won't, or a young child, they may not even know that they've had it. So they ought to think about getting a hepatitis A vaccine.
Right, and you could screen people because some people have gotten it as children and they didn't know it.
Right.
But it's not cost-effective to do that. It's more cost-effective. One other thing that I think occurs in uncommonly, but we have had some outbreaks in the U.S. from contaminated food that's come from other countries like Mexico and gotten contaminated like berries or onions or something like that. And then there's been an outbreak and they've been recalled and the outbreak stops. Those are really uncommon and there's not enough to justify the cost of the vaccine, but there certainly is for travelers. But someday they might make that recommendation that all adults get vaccinated.
One more comment about this, and I'm going to dragging that in here, and we're going to talk about hepatitis C. We'll jump back to B because I want to get her involved. But thinking about this as an epidemiologist, then people my age, people older people probably got hepatitis A. Young infants from 20 years or less have been immunized to a large degree. So it's particularly young adults, 20 to 40, probably, I'm just guessing, I'll figure it on the top of my head, who are really the ones that are also at high risk.
And that's true. And if you're over the age of 50, there's a 30 to 50% chance you've already had it. The problem is that if you get hepatitis A over 50, you have a much, you usually get a lot sicker and you have a higher mortality. The mortality risk is 1 to 2% from the acute hepatitis. So I think, and since the vaccine is safe for every age, I think that if you're going to go somewhere, get that vaccine no matter what age you are, even though you might have already had it when if you're older.
Okay. All right. Let me once again let people know this is Line 1, your health connection that you're listening to. We're originating from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage. Our topic today is hepatitis A, B, and C. My guests are Annette Hewitt. She's a nurse practitioner working with patients with hepatitis, particularly hepatitis C and other liver diseases at the Liver Disease and Hepatitis Program at ANMC, and Dr. Brian McMahon, who is really kind of a world expert on hepatitis B. He's helped develop World Health Organization guidelines and the U.S. guidelines, and he is the medical director of the Liver Disease and Hepatitis Program at ANMC. An excellent opportunity to call or email and ask your questions about hepatitis. So, Annette, what do we need to say? What do you want listeners to hear about hepatitis C?
Well, for a long time, treatments for hepatitis C were really very difficult to take, and very few people were able to be cured. But starting in 2013, direct-acting antiviral medications were developed, and now we're able to treat people, many more people. Most people who have hepatitis C can take these medications, and we can cure over 90% of the people that we treat with these medications, and they have very few side effects. So if you're at risk for hepatitis C, or if you do have hepatitis C and you haven't seen your healthcare provider because you thought there was nothing that could be done about it, I think it's really important that you get back in and talk with your healthcare provider about what's available now for hepatitis C, because there's a good chance you can be cured. And hepatitis C is a silent infection, like Brian said, and it goes on for years and years. People don't realize that they have this infection, and after 20 to 40 years with hepatitis C chronically infecting the liver, you can end up with liver disease, cirrhosis. It's the leading cause for liver cancer, and it can kill people. So if you have the infection, I think it's important to be tested and be treated. And if it doesn't kill you, you can still have a diminished quality of life, is what studies have shown, that people who have hepatitis, chronic hepatitis C infection, tend to maybe be a little more tired and not have as much energy, and maybe have more heart disease or other health problems.
So hepatitis C is transmitted by needle stick bloodborne exposures. It sits around in the humans for a long time without much in the way of symptoms. What about, fatigue is not an uncommon issue in medicine. And people do screening lab tests and they get liver functions that are abnormal. Does that mean anything as far as hepatitis C, or does it depend on your age or past history, or how would you answer that question?
Well, not everyone who has hepatitis C has elevated liver function tests. So okay. I think if your liver function tests have always been normal, that does not mean that you don't have hepatitis C. If liver screening tests are abnormal, especially an elevated ALT, then you should be screened for hepatitis C, even if you don't believe that you have any risk factors for hepatitis C.
So what are the risk factors for hepatitis C? Is there a particular age group, like we just discussed with hepatitis A, that we should let people be aware of?
I think it's really important that everyone who was born between the years of 1945 and 1965 know that hepatitis C has historically been diagnosed more commonly in people in this age group. So 3 out of 4 people who have been positive for hepatitis C have been found to be in this baby boomer generation. So the CDC and the United States Preventive Task Force has recommended that everyone born between 1945 and 1965 have a one-time test for the hepatitis C antibody, regardless of whether or not they've had any risk factors for hepatitis C. Mm-hmm. So,
why is that?
Well, you know, like Brian alluded, that our, you know, medical safety, hygienic practices were not as advanced as they are now. So we were reusing, syringes. And I remember my mom talking about sharpening needles back in the 50s when she was working in the hospital. Sterilization techniques weren't as good, and we didn't realize hepatitis C can live on surfaces, and it's transmitted. It's been known that it's been transmitted through finger stick testing if the equipment is not changed between patients. Blood transfusions likely transmitted hepatitis C before we had testing. So before 1992, if people were diagnosed with hepatitis C and it wasn't hepatitis B and it wasn't hepatitis A, but it was a viral hepatitis, we knew it was hepatitis non-A, non-B hepatitis. And mm-hmm. that was likely hepatitis C that we were transmitting to people without knowing.
Mm-hmm. So I'll reiterate that when I was a kid, I'm not telling anybody over the air what my age is, but when I was a kid, I just remember going to the dentist, no gloves, blood's flying all over the place, and they changed the little drill bit, but they didn't really, they kind of wiped off the drill with alcohol, which really doesn't kill the virus. And now, you know, they sterilize the drill, they change the drill, they change the tubing, they wear gloves, they wear masks, and we used to give injections with glass syringes, which are hard to sterilize. We used the same vial multiple times in different patients, easy to contaminate it. So a lot of people were now really appreciating that probably up to about a third of the people with Hep C got it because of the way we practiced health before AIDS came along, and we realized we needed to be really more careful than we were. Mm-hmm. And that's why the baby boomer recommendation came out. There was a lot of injection drug use back in the 60s and 70s during the Vietnam War, but it's more than that. It was blood transfusions, no screening for hepatitis, no test for hepatitis C, and then the way we practiced healthcare back in those days.
Mm-hmm. You know, Brian, and either one of you, it just dawned on me. We know AIDS got transmitted through blood transfusions or components of blood that was being used in particular for hemophilia. I don't remember anything about hepatitis C in the hemophilia. Am I missing something? Is that, do you have any answers about that? Curiosity just came to my mind. Anybody ever look back and see if that was an issue?
You know, I think that when people found the virus and identified it in the early 1990s, there was a number of studies in hemophilia patients, mm-hmm. and about 90% of them, 80-90%, had Hep C. Mm-hmm. And what I think happened is that we didn't have very good treatment for hemophilia back in the 50s and 60s, and people are beginning to realize that the main epidemic of hepatitis C, we always thought it was during the Vietnam War, but it actually occurred around World War II. And it was what happened is there was this huge demand for blood products during World War II.
Right.
And the techniques were not very good. And so a lot of people got infected. I just read an article on this during that time period from contaminated blood products. And, gamma globin was developed to prevent hepatitis A, for example. Lots of transfusions were done in the battlefield, and a lot of people came home with hepatitis C, and that actually, even though there was a surge of hepatitis C during the injecting drug use of the 60s and 70s, this article contended that most of that disease came from the 40s and 50s during the time of increasing use of blood transfusions and blood products.
Yeah. I mean, you could even argue if there'd never been an AIDS epidemic because of the long lead time between the infection and illness, clinical illness, we might not even have still been perhaps aware that hepatitis C may have been, I mean, that may be extending things, yeah. But the reason we figured out hepatitis or HIV is because of the lead time was still a number of years, but a little bit quicker.
Yeah, and I think certainly was quicker. And with hepatitis C, we would have found out eventually because the incidence of liver cancer just shot up in the United States. It's tripled. And most of it in the U.S. is related to hep C. And we would have figured that out sooner or later, but it would have taken a lot longer.
All right. We have a caller. And before we take our break, I want to ask Rick what his question is. Rick, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi, thank you. I do have a question, but prior to that, I'd just like to say as a sidebar, we're pretty advanced medically. There are still plenty of places in, if you will, third countries where a lot of materials are being recycled. So even though, you talk about glass syringes and stuff, that's still happening in a lot of places. So for people who are traveling, I just would, want them to recognize that even if they go to a doctor's office or a hospital, they may not be getting the most sterile equipment use, just as a sidebar.
Okay.
What I'd like to find out is, my question is, I have a nephew who has hepatitis C. And from everything I have heard, from what he has been able to find out, his treatment costs, he's looking at like $100,000 to have treatment for hepatitis C. Is that the case in the U.S.? Is hepatitis C that expensive, or is there a treatment for that, or are there alternatives to such a high bill?
Yep, good question. That is an issue. All right, let's ask Annette about it. She's the one who's using these medications every day.
Yeah, unfortunately, the cost for these hepatitis C medications is it's prohibitive for people who don't have health insurance. If your nephew has any access to health insurance, and with expansion of the Affordable Care Act, maybe he could get a hold of some health insurance, and that would help him pay for these medications. There are also patient assistance programs, and I would urge him to talk with his health care provider about any assistance programs. There are programs available to help pay for these medications, but this is something he should talk with his health care provider about.
He is on the outside of that loop. He doesn't have health care. He's kind of in a bad way in terms of having health support.
Somebody
outside of that loop,
I would really recommend that he, if he doesn't have health insurance, that he go to like a neighborhood health center. If he's in Anchorage, he could, avail himself of the Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center, or maybe Providence Family Practice, or, some kind of a sliding scale institution. We see these patients in hepatitis C program who are outside of the healthcare system, but we really want to encourage people to get reconnect with someone because care is available.
Okay. Well, I appreciate it. Yeah, he's not here. He's in Hawaii, but and I presume he's checked local health clinic.
I'll just add something to that before you go. As Annette said, most of the companies that make these drugs, there's now three companies that are really making most of the drugs, and they're all 95% curative. Their side effects are minimal. They have free drug programs that if you have you make less than $50,000 or $100,000 a year, you can qualify for those programs, and they will deliver that drug to a pharmacy to give you at no cost. And so there are many pharmacies now that work with the company, and they work with the primary with the providers, so that they can get those drugs for these patients. So tell him to go see one of the community health clinics if he doesn't have a provider. And I know there's those clinics in Hawaii, and have them try to help them with this, because there's no reason he shouldn't be able to get this medication.
I appreciate that very much. Can you tell me the name of the pharmaceutical companies that are producing these?
There's Merck and Company, and then there's AbbVie, which is part of Abbott Laboratories, or AbbVie, A-B-V-I-E, and then there's Gilead, G-I-L-E-A-D. All three of those companies make curative direct-acting antiviral combination drugs. They all take about 8 to 12 weeks and cure 95%.
Thank you very much for your time, you guys. Appreciate it.
All right.
Thank you
for your call. All right. We are about halfway or more through the program, so I'm going to take a one-minute break and remind listeners once again you're listening to Line 1, your health connection, our local number, 550-8433. We have an email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a very short, roughly one-minute break, and we'll continue our discussion on hepatitis A, B, and C with Annette Hewitt and Dr. Brian McMahon. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Back. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection. We're originating from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Our guests today are Annette Hewitt. She's a nurse practitioner that works with patients primarily with hepatitis C, but other hepatitis and liver diseases at the Liver Disease and Hepatitis Program at the Alaska Native Medical Center. Also is Dr. Brian McMahon. He is here in the studio. He's the co-chair of the World Health Organization Hepatitis B Guidelines and helped develop the U.S. practice guidelines for hepatitis B as well. Dr. McMahon is the medical director of the Liver Disease and Hepatitis Program at Alaska Native Medical Center. So, as you might have guessed, we're talking about hepatitis A, B, and C. We've quickly kind of put hepatitis A back, and if you want to hear something more about that, you can go to our archives at alaskapublic.media in the Line 1 link and listen to that program. Or listen to this program at any time. We have not talked about hepatitis B. We're going to continue to focus on hepatitis C for just a little bit longer. You can email questions and comments to line1@alaskapublic.org. You can contact us locally through 550-8433. And our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. So, Annette, we've identified that a particularly high risk of people with hepatitis C, 25 to 50% of them who do not know they have it, are particularly that group of people born between 1945 and 1965, which includes me. The reasons could have been that they might be infected through iatrogenic medical accidents before we knew enough about protecting against viral diseases like this and needle sticks and so forth, and or interactions with needle stick exposure through drug recreational drug experimentation in their lifetime. So there's a couple of reasons. How about now? What's the risk now of getting hepatitis C through medical misfiring?
Yeah, well, the risk of getting hepatitis C through medical, practice in the United States is really low now. So very low. I think, as our caller, Rick, mentioned, outside of the United States in third world countries, the risk through medical practices is much higher. But in the United States, we're aware and practicing medicine now, so that hopefully this doesn't happen, not reusing any needles and using disposable medical equipment.
Okay. All right. So here's an email that came in, and we may need to define some terms a little bit, but it says, we adopted our daughter from China 16 years ago. At that time, she tested positive for hepatitis C. And I am going to guess that this was an antibody test. And I want you to focus on the difference between antibody and antigen when you answer this question, because she didn't say that. She was 8 months old when she was tested, roughly 16 years ago. And she was, and the doctor at that time told her she was probably not really infected, and that if we tested again after a year, she would be negative, which was the case, which turned out to be the case. Yep.
Okay, I think I know what happened here. It's probably hepatitis B and not C. And it would have been hepatitis B core antibody. Well, that's how the C got in there.
Because of the age.
Yeah, because of the age. So what happens is that in China, most adults have had hepatitis B, and about 10 to 15% of adults are infected and have the virus and can transmit it. So there's two possibilities. One, this baby's mom was actually virus positive and transmitted, but the baby didn't get a high enough level of virus that the baby was able to recover. And the second, which is I think the most likely explanation, is that the mother was immune. The mother had actually gotten hepatitis B as a child, but recovered, and then still had these lifelong antibodies. There's two antibodies, the core and the surface antibody. And transmitted those antibodies across the placenta. Actually, they crossed when the baby was actually, before the baby was born, they crossed the placenta. And the baby, it took about a year to get rid of those antibodies. They're circulating around, like a lot of mother's other antibodies that moms have. And then by the time the baby was 1 year of age or above, the antibodies, mom's antibodies, disappeared and the baby was negative for everything. That baby should have been vaccinated. If not, that child needs to be vaccinated against hepatitis B.
All right, so the final part of that question was, does this help her in any way with future exposures? She had antibodies. She, as a child, had antibodies or a negative. It's not clear what that means. So to reemphasize what you said is, because of the age when this test was done, it's highly unlikely the test was for hepatitis C, but the antibody test that was done may have had C in it for core antibodies, hepatitis C core antibodies, and so there could have been confusing. If those antibodies disappeared, which sounds like they did, then she is not immunized, and she should have had hepatitis B antibody testing or immunization since then.
Exactly, and if she didn't get it as a child, she needs to go into the doctor and get that vaccination now. And it's unlikely that she has acquired it in this time, because we, just like hepatitis A, we don't have hardly any transmission going on in Alaska. It's less than one per 100,000. But that child is not protected unless she's been vaccinated. It's possible that she got vaccinated in China, but then we would have expected that she would have had one of those two antibodies persisting at 1.5 years, and the fact that there was no antibodies present would mean that they all disappeared and then she's not protected.
And if, God forbid, we were wrong and she did have a hepatitis C test that was positive and then became negative after a year, she is no longer protected. She can still get hepatitis C. And Annette, there's no vaccine, unlike hepatitis A and B. Is that true?
Right. And for this little girl, if she had been tested for the hepatitis C antibody at 8 months, she, again, this would be her mother's antibody. And generally, we don't test babies until they're 18 months of age for hepatitis C antibody because of that, because of the mother's immune system. And once a person's been infected with hepatitis C, about 15 to 25% of people clear that hepatitis C infection. They don't go on to develop chronic infection, but they maintain the hepatitis C antibody. Unlike the hepatitis A antibody, which is protective, the hepatitis C antibody is not protective. And anyone who's had hepatitis C infection in the past can still get infected with hepatitis C again. And unfortunately, there is no vaccination against hepatitis C now, and it's been difficult to develop a vaccination because it is a very heterogeneous virus. There are at least 6 different genotypes, likely more. There are over 50 subtypes, and trying to develop a vaccination has been really difficult, and I don't understand all of that, but I know it's been difficult to develop a vaccination. I know that they're working on developing a vaccination, but there isn't anything to protect yourself from hepatitis C by avoiding any risk exposure.
Brian had sent me a comment before the program that I'm going to bring up and see if you can answer, or Brian may have to. He said that many insurers are not covering treatment, I think he says, unless there is significant disease. And so it sounds like despite clear recommendations and obvious need to treat, that mild disease is not being covered by insurance companies, I guess because they're assuming that we don't know which one of these people are going to go ahead and have serious problems, but a significant group will.
Well, we don't know who's going to go on to develop problems, right, which is why we should treat everyone. And more insurers are covering people with mild disease. The state of California's Medicaid, their Medicaid program, and New York's state program now is covering all comers, including people with mild disease. Our state has lowered the amount of disease that a person needs to have prior to treatment. So if you think you have mild disease and you won't qualify for treatment, I think it's really important for you to continue to pursue that, because there are avenues for treatment for everyone. Because we don't know who's going to go on to develop serious disease. So 40 to 50% of people who have chronic hepatitis C infection could go on to develop, chronic liver disease. And of those, 20% of those people could go on to develop cirrhosis. And 1 to 5% of all people with hepatitis C will die from their liver disease, from liver cancer. So, and we don't know who that person is going to be.
So if I could, can I add something to that?
Sure.
So, these drugs are very expensive. They're very safe. They don't cost a lot to make. Just a few $100s for a course of 12 weeks. So there's a lot of controversy about the price that's being charged. And I think everybody's been reading the newspaper and watching the news about all kinds of drug prices that are way out of the range of what they should be. And the way the pharmaceutical companies costed them was they figured how much it costs to take care of somebody during their life with Hep C, and it was over $100,000, so that's how they came up with the number. But for insurance companies and Medicare, Medicaid, to pay that all up front, it would be like saying to a diabetic, we have a cure for diabetes now, it costs $1 million to take care of them, so we'll charge $1 million for this cure. It would be very difficult for companies to do that. So the companies, which was really surprising to everyone and Medicaid, decided they would put a level of scarring on the score. And how do you get that? Well, the best way to get it, and this is not recommended anymore, is a liver biopsy. That's an invasive procedure. And the second best way of getting it is something called FibroScan, which is a form of ultrasound that can measure how much scarring is in the liver. So we got at the ANMC the first FibroScan machine in the state. Providence now has one. So really there's only 2 machines in the state. It's totally safe, like any ultrasound. It takes 10 minutes, and it's not very expensive, but there's not a lot of availability of FibroScan. But that's one of the ways that you can find out how much scarring you have.
Okay.
And then there's some serologic tests you can do too, but FibroScan is probably the best way to do it. And the insurance companies and Medicaid will accept the FibroScan score. The problem is if it's really, really low, they'll then say, well, we're not going to fund you. So we've done some part of our work. We do a lot of research. We've looked at what are the risks if somebody has different stages of fibrosis of them getting some horrible complication. So if you have cirrhosis, and most people have cirrhosis don't know it, it's asymptomatic until they get really sick, you have a 50% chance over the next 5 years of either dying of liver disease, getting liver cancer, or your liver fails on you, need a transplant. If you have close to cirrhosis, you've got about a 30% chance. If you have moderate amount of scarring, which is kind of the cutoff right now for Medicare or for Medicaid, and some insurances will not fund this level, there's about a 10% chance. And if you have really, really mild disease, like you get a low fiber scan score, you've only got about a 3% chance or so of getting into trouble in 5 years, but you still need to be followed and treated. So that's one of the things, that it's not dangerous in general not to treat people with mild disease. But as Annette said, if this is a chronic inflammatory disease, it increases your risk of heart disease, diabetes, stroke, and other complications. So we really do need, the goal needs to be to treat everybody. Maybe we're going to prioritize people at first, but we really need to treat everybody.
All right, Diane, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Well, I think part of my questions have been answered, but perhaps you can also ensure that your website has a follow-up for some of these. For people who have traveled across the world, including India, from the 60s through the 90s, what should they, are there tests, simple tests that could tell them, are they infected? And, of course, you just mentioned the scan. I think that maybe when some of my family came back from India in the 90s, there was some test to see if they had one of these diseases, but I just can't remember either A or B, because I don't think C was very popular then. But I'm not really, can't find the records, don't really know what they, I think they were negative. However, what should we do if we're concerned? And if we continue to travel, how do we protect ourselves?
Okay. All right. So let's, the testing, Annette, Brian, either one of you, it's not a difficult thing to do. You just go to your doctor and?
Or the Alaska Health Fairs now. If you mm-hmm. don't have your doctor, they'll do your hepatitis testing there. And
B and C and?
No, for C. I'm sorry. I don't know about B.
Yeah, okay. I think,
but they will do a hepatitis C antibody test, mm-hmm. which so, is what she would want.
So I think, you know, with one little tube of blood, you can do all three. And they have mm-hmm. panels that have all three on them so that your provider could test you for those. And if you've done a lot of traveling, it might be worth getting it. And then if you're negative for Hep A, get the Hep A vaccine. If you're negative for Hep B and you're going to keep traveling, get the Hep B vaccine, because you can get it from other countries. And then there's nothing for Hep C, but if you're a baby boomer, you should get tested for that anyway. And if you've got it, they'll cure you in 12 weeks if you've got insurance. Or you can get the drug, usually get the drugs from the company for free if you don't. So that's what I would just go to my doctor and say, screen me for all the hepatitis tests, do a panel on me and find out what I've got, and then tell me what vaccines I need.
Okay, that sounds good. And how to protect ourselves?
Exactly. With the vaccines are the best way to protect yourself.
And avoid exposure to blood or anything that might be contaminated.
Okay. That's it. That's the best. Just don't get sick overseas, right?
Don't get sick.
All right, thank you.
All right, have a good day. Brian, hepatitis B. We've already let the cat out of the bag. There's a vaccine. The vaccine is extremely effective and helpful. And I don't know, what do we need to talk about? Vertical transmission, for sure.
I think we need to talk about a couple things. One is that all women are supposed to be screened for Hep B in the United States. And then the babies would get, if the mother's positive, they would get, in addition to the vaccine, which is recommended for all babies, they would get something called hepatitis B immune globulin, which is a gamma globulin with lots of antibodies for hepatitis B in it. And the new thing in the new practice guideline that just came out this past summer is that if the mom has a high level of virus, more than 200,000 units, then it's recommended that that mother, in addition to decrease the risk of transmission from about 10% with vaccine and HBIG to zero, in addition, take an antiviral drug, tenofovir, in the third trimester of pregnancy, and then continue that on for at least 6 weeks after pregnancy. And tenofovir is very safe in pregnancy. It's also a drug. There's no relationship between hepatitis B and HIV, but it's also a drug which is active against HIV, and it's been used in millions of women, pregnant women in other countries with HIV and in this country. And there's no increased incidence of adverse outcomes for either mother or baby. So that would be the other recommendation that I think providers are beginning to recognize. So that's the most important thing. The second thing is that all children, it's recommended that they get that first dose of vaccine, even if the mother's negative at birth. And then in Alaska, there's three more doses. Why at birth? Because this is a very infectious virus on environmental services that, you know, it's very uncommon, but a baby can get infected as a young child. Vaccination is delayed. And there's a myth amongst many practitioners that hepatitis B is only transmitted by bad behavior. And that's true. It is transmitted by bad behavior, sex and drugs. But the greatest risk of the chronic infection and liver cancer and cirrhosis is getting infected as a child. And in most of the world, that's when people get infected. They're not using sex and drugs as children. Under five, they get infected from environmental services or from their mothers. So it is recommended that children get vaccinated at birth. The other thing that's important about hepatitis B is that there's very little new infection in the U.S. Because of the vaccination of all children. But there is a huge number of people that are immigrating to the United States that have hepatitis B and that have no symptoms. I just today got sent a paper from a friend. 16% of persons born in the Philippines have chronic hepatitis B and are at risk for getting liver cancer or cirrhosis. If you're born in China, anywhere in Asia, anywhere in East Europe, Russia, the Amazon region of South America, but not Mexico, and if you're born in the Caribbean, you're at a high risk for having chronic hepatitis B, and the recommendation is you should be tested. Your insurance will pay for it. For hepatitis B once in your life. So we urge any people born outside the U.S. except for Western Europe and Mexico to get tested for hepatitis B and make sure that they're not chronically infected and they don't suddenly get sick with liver cancer or liver failure.
So with hepatitis B, we have a vaccine which is very effective for a long period of time. Do we know how long the vaccine has been shown to be effective so far?
Yeah, we've been doing the longest study in the world on how well this vaccine works. We're going out this fall for our 35-year follow-up in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta in Norton Sound, where we're working with those corporations out there. We've been doing this monitoring and with the participation of a lot of really good Alaska Native people that really want to help out and find out how long protection lasts and if boosters are needed. And at 30 years, we found that there is no need for a booster. People will be able to recognize this virus. And we even did some very sophisticated immunologic studies looking at Dr. Brenna Simons at our hospital, an immunologist, did a lot of work with persons at the University of Alaska doing looking lymphocyte studies and cytokines, and found that people who've been vaccinated recognize this virus in many different ways 30 years later. So this is really good news. One other thing that I want to mention also is that we have great drugs for hepatitis B right now. They just don't cure it. We're where we were 10 years ago with hepatitis C. I think in 10 years we're going to be able to cure hep B, but we can't get rid of this virus now. We can only suppress it, but people who have active liver disease who need the antiviral drug, and not everybody needs it, it'll suppress the disease, it'll decrease their risk of getting cirrhosis, reverse the cirrhosis if they have early cirrhosis, and dramatically decrease the risk of liver cancer by about 60 or 70%. So if you have hepatitis B and you're found to be positive on screening, then your doctor needs to monitor you every 6 months and work with an expert in infectious disease or gastroenterology here in town. And if you need antiviral therapy, you'd be put on antiviral therapy. But it's usually lifelong. And it's one pill a day, no side effects or rare side effects. But it costs money, and we don't give it to everybody unless they really absolutely need it and we know there's going to be a benefit.
Annette, What's happening to the epidemiology of hepatitis C? Are we seeing increasing numbers of cases, decreasing numbers of cases? Do you know that off the top of your head?
Yeah, it's unfortunate we're seeing more hepatitis C. Since 2010, we've had a spike in hepatitis C diagnoses, likely related to the IV opioid use epidemic.
Mm-hmm. So it was dropping, and now we've got some problems related to unclean needles, needle sharing
issues. And we're seeing this in the younger population, people under the age of 30. And using your own needle, using your own syringe does not protect you from hepatitis C. Hepatitis C is transmitted through all the paraphernalia that's used in drug use, spoons, cottons, tourniquets. Hepatitis C is lives on these surfaces, and it's easily transmitted. It does live in syringes for a long period of time. We don't know how long. So it's really important. It'd be great to have some needle and syringe exchange programs for this this population. Unfortunately, it would be it's important that we address the opioid epidemic.
And one of the things about the opioid epidemic is that much of the problem has been providers giving too many opioid medications to patients. We're trying to educate providers. We want to educate patients not to allow your provider to give you 30 or 50 oxycodones after you've injured your knee or something. Give me a couple days supply. And be very careful, because it's easy to get addicted to these drugs. And many of the people we see with who are using heroin are middle-class young people who got addicted after they injured themselves in sports or other ways.
Brian, I want to quickly, we've done a show on this, and I want to make it very clear that people who are listening to this, we're not talking about end-of-life care of the use of opioids.
Exactly. All
right,
exactly. No.
Before we've got confused about this, and that is not what we're talking about.
No, we're talking about the person who gets injured and needs these drugs for a short period.
Right. Okie doke. Where are we? Got about a minute, and I had one more comment here. Annette, I think you wanted to say something about people who are on maybe immunosuppressant treatments and need for hepatitis B screening.
Yeah, I wanted Brian to be sure to address persons who have hepatitis B, core antibody positive, might not be actively infected with hepatitis B, but receiving immunotherapy like chemotherapy.
Yeah, anybody who's got hepatitis B, if they get chemo or immunotherapy, there's a high chance they're going to reactivate and get sick. People who had it and recovered and never will get into trouble, the virus does persist, you know, in small amounts in your liver. And if you get certain very potent drugs like treatment for a lymphoma or leukemia, you can reactivate. So ask your doctor to screen you for hepatitis B. You see those ads about the different drugs that are used for rheumatoid arthritis and things like that, saying, tell your doctor if you have hepatitis B. It should be, ask your doctor to test me for hepatitis B and then advise me whether or not I need to take a drug.
All right. Another quick hour. Thanks very much to my guests, Ann Hewitt and Dr. Brian McMahon of the Liver Disease and Hepatitis Program at ANMC. Thanks very much.
You're welcome. Thanks for inviting us.
If you want to continue this discussion on hepatitis, you can join KSKA on Facebook, and you can find that link at our website, www.alaskapublic.org, where you'll also find the Line 1 archives. You can listen to this program at any time at those archives. On the next Line 1, we're going to discuss marijuana legalization and how the state of Alaska is preparing for this. Our guests are Cindy Franklin, she's the Director of Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office, and Dr. Jay Butler, he's the Chief Medical Officer and the Director of the Division of Public Health. Pat Yak is Chief Content Officer. Dave Waldron, audio engineer, today's program. Eric Bork is our web editor. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.